We've got a lot to cover today, so I'm not going to review our previous lesson. And since our Ruth study is only 8 lessons long, counting today's, I think if you want to go over it again on your own, it's not that big of a task. So what we're going to conclude with today is essentially a highly technical legal matter. And so we have little choice but to go into great detail to properly understand it, right? Since it is so foreign to our laws and our culture in the 21st century West, especially the West. So we'll begin by rereading the entire final chapter of Ruth, Ruth chapter 4, to refresh our memories. So open your Bibles to Ruth chapter 4 and follow along with me. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 1060. 1060. Meanwhile, Boaz had gone up to the gate and he had sat down there when the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken passed by. "Such and such," he said. "Come over, sit down." So he came over and sat down. And he took 10 of the city's leaders and said, "Sit down here." And they sat down. And then he said to the redeeming kinsman, "The parcel of land which used to belong to our relative Elimelech is being offered for sale by Naomi, who has returned from the plains of Moab. I thought I should tell you about it and say, buy it in the presence of the people sitting here and in the presence of the leaders of my people. If you want to redeem it, redeem it. But if it is not to be redeemed, tell me, so that I can know, because there was no one else in line to redeem it. I'm after you." He said, "I want to redeem it." And then Boaz said, "The same day that you buy the field from Naomi, you must also buy Ruth, the woman from Moab, the wife of the deceased son, in order to raise up in the name of the deceased an heir for his property." The redeemer said, "Well, then I can't redeem it for myself, because I might put my own inheritance at risk. You take my right of redemption on yourself, because I can't redeem it." Well, in the past, this is what was done in Israel to validate all transactions involving redemption and exchange. A man took off his shoe, and he gave it to the other party. This was the form of attestation in Israel. So the redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," and took off his shoe. Boaz addressed the leaders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I am purchasing from Naomi all that belong to Elimelech, all that belong to Chilion and Mahlon. Also, I am acquiring as my wife Ruth, the woman from Moab, the wife of Mahlon, in order to raise up in the name of the deceased an heir for his property, so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his kinsmen and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses today." All the people at the gate and the leaders said, "We are witnesses. May Adonai make the woman who has come into your house like Rachel and like Leah, who between them built up the house of Israel. Do worthy deeds in Ephrath. Become renowned in Beit Lechem. May your house, because of the seed Adonai will give you from this young woman, become like the house of Peretz, whom Tamar bore to Judah." So Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. He had sexual relations with her, and Adonai enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be Adonai, who today has provided you a redeemer. May his name be renowned in Israel. May he restore your life and provide for your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him." Naomi took the child and laid it on her breast and became its nurse. The women who were her neighbors gave it a name. They said, "A son has been born to Naomi," and called it Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Here is the genealogy of Peretz. Peretz was the father of Hetzron. Hetzron was the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Aminadav. Aminadav was the father of Nachshon. Nachshon was the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz, and Boaz was the father of Oved. Oved was the father of Yishai, and Yishai was the father of David. So the legal process to determine just who would assume the duties of Naomi's family goel, the family redeemer, that in Christendom is usually called the kinsman redeemer, this whole process has begun. Would it be Boaz, or rather the unnamed, more senior relative who was first in line to be the goel? Well, the morning after Ruth visited Boaz at the threshing floor, Boaz went to the city gate of Bethlehem, waited for the senior family goel to walk by, and also asked that 10 of the recognized city elders attend this public proceeding so as to essentially validate and then notarize the outcome. Verse 3 begins a very difficult dialogue between Boaz and Mr. So-and-so to translate, to interpret it, to make sense of it. At least partly because there is a very strange changing of verb tenses regarding the current status of Naomi's land. Has it already been sold, or is it only now being sold? Now, due to the West's obsession with eroticism and romance, the story of Ruth is usually made to be one of this young widow Ruth being rescued by the kindly gentleman Boaz. In reality, the main focus of the story has to do with Naomi and the transfer of family land. One verse seems to say that the selling of the land had already occurred. In other words, before this meeting at the city gates. And yet another verse seems to say that what is about to transpire at the city gates is the selling of the land. Now, because we always read this in English, the difficulty is that the Hebrew is oftentimes masked because the translator of your particular English version made the decision, he had to, that either the land had already been sold or it was now in the process of being sold, and so made all the verb tenses neatly match, at least in English, to reflect his own personal conclusion. But there is even more trouble contained in these verses. And we talked about some of it last time. In summary, the trouble is this. The usual assumption by Christian scholars and commentators going back centuries is that Ruth and Boaz were about to engage in levirate marriage, and that this marriage solved the dilemma of the land transfer from Naomi by creating this needed heir, a son that would eventually be born to Ruth and Boaz. Well, yes and no. You see, what transpires in these passages, frankly, does not carry out the very detailed Torah commandments regarding levirate marriage, nor the specific Torah-defined duties that are required of a kinsman redeemer, a goel. So many Bible scholars have simply decided that the text has been corrupted. So they use that as their reason for ignoring what is actually written, and essentially create their own version of the story as a substitute. I will tell you that by doing that, it certainly makes studying this final chapter of Ruth quicker and a lot easier. But I also think we're missing a great deal by not trying to deal with this challenging text of Ruth just as it was recorded. Now, I hope by now that you're all accepting that the biggest problem that we face today in understanding the Bible is that we are modern Westerners. And the way that we think and the way that we reason was birthed in Greek culture. Even more specifically, in the Greek culture as practiced in the era of the Western Roman Empire. But what we read in the Bible is entirely based on Eastern culture, on ancient Hebrew thinking patterns. Even the New Testament, that admittedly was largely written in Greek, nonetheless was dictated by Hebrew individuals like Paul and Peter, who were Easterners. So trying to jot down Eastern cultural thinking patterns in a Western Roman Greek language and alphabet is inherently difficult, and much gets lost in the translation. The good news is that about half of the passages in the New Testament are merely direct quotes taken from the Old Testament. So we can go back and we can cross-reference those Greek New Testament passages to their original Old Testament Hebrew counterparts. And that helps us to get a much better sense of how we should understand them. But it still won't help much when studying the Bible until we train ourselves to think in the Eastern Hebrew thought patterns that were the basis for the scriptures in the first place. The notion that the Bible is so mystical and magical that culture and language and era and even context doesn't matter when reading it is absurd on its face. It's only useful when one simply wants to teach a specific man-made religious doctrine as opposed to what the Word of God actually says. It is this exact issue that's at play, especially in Ruth chapter 4. And so I'm going to delve into some depth in trying to help decipher what's really happening among these Jewish Israelites who are bargaining at the city gates, as opposed to what it might seem to be occurring to us modern Gentiles. Now, first notice in verse 3 that the person who is the central figure in this negotiation is Naomi. It's not Ruth. And this is because Naomi is the widow of Elimelech. Elimelech was the owner of the piece of land that's in question. So his widow, Naomi, the only survivor, now represents Elimelech's clan and family. However, there's a problem with that. Does Naomi really own that land? Since her husband and both of her sons, who would have been the legal heirs of Elimelech's real property, since they both died? The short answer must be no, she's not. Because there is no provision in Torah law for a widow to inherit land from her deceased husband. Notice I didn't say there was no provision for a female to ever inherit land, because indeed the daughters of Zelophehad pled their case to Moses because Zelophehad had no sons, only daughters. He pled his case to Moses, and Moses decided, as God's earthly mediator, that daughters could inherit their father's real property. That's not the case with Naomi. The land in question didn't belong to her father, it belonged to her husband. So the land was not Naomi's to hold. Saying it was Naomi's land was just kind of a figure of speech. It was a way of identifying it. Simple, common way of saying this is the parcel we're talking about. For the people of that era, the issue of what happens to family land, the family land with someone like Elimelech, was a constant thought. Land was everything to an agricultural-based society. You know, it represented their heritage, their intended place on this earth. It was where they grew their food. It was the primary repository of their earthly wealth, no matter how meager. It is difficult for me to put into words what the possession of land meant then and means now even to rural farmers and ranchers. These folks feel more of a personal connection to the land than mere ownership. Suburban and city folks, you know, we just see land as a tradable commodity. And while there might be some sentimental family attachment to one's longtime family home, it's not the land that's the issue. It's the memories of life within that dwelling structure that are seen as irreplaceable. The centrality of land is a really difficult concept for the majority of Westerners who don't own ranches or farms. But as I have extended family who does have a large farm, I'm familiar with their genuine depth of attachment to it and the lengths they will go never to lose it, but rather to keep it in the family generation after generation. And it was especially so for Israel, because the Lord God had embedded the principle that the original owner of a piece of the promised land was to maintain it in his family forever. Let's be clear that while the immediate family, extended family in our modern vocabulary, ideally held on to that land, in reality, it was the clan to which that family belonged that was even more important. In other words, while the land could be transferred under a variety of circumstances among the many separate families that formed a clan, it was always to stay within the clan. But the hierarchy of land ownership went even further. If by some calamity the original family, along with the entire clan, were wiped out, are incapable of retaining the land, then the next best hope was for the tribe to which the clan and so the family belonged to claim it. If that clan's tribe were wiped out or was incapable of assuming the land, then some other Israelite tribe was to control it. But the loss of ownership of land to a Gentile foreigner? Well, that was just unthinkable. And it was not authorized by God. Even then, among the Hebrews, there were the laws of Jubilee. And this law allowed for the return of the land, debt-free and at no cost, to the original owner or family of the descendants, even though this opportunity only arose once every half century. Further, even though I just spoke in common terms of land ownership, in reality, no Israelite ever owned the land in the way that we think of owning land today. Most ownership of land in the Western world is called fee simple ownership. And it means that a person has absolute control and all rights to that land without limitation and can sell it whenever and to whomever he pleases. And these same rights of ownership then transfer to the new owner in perpetuity. But an Israelite did not ever own the land of Israel. He only owned the use of it. Just the use of it. He could dwell on it. He could grow crops on it. He could raise animals on it. He could use the land, but it was to remain in the control of his family, clan, and tribe forever. However, the fee simple owner, if you would, of the land was God. That's the way they looked at it. That's the way the Torah is actually set up. I cannot say this strongly enough. Christians today rather sloppily throw around the phrase, oh, my house belongs to the Lord God. Or that, oh, my car belongs to Jesus. Well, that's only true in a spiritual, idealistic, figurative sense, isn't it? God is not on the deed. He's not on the title. Even if your church might be. And our modern laws provide for fee simple ownership of land and chattel as our standard ownership principle. This was not the case with the Israelites and the Promised Land. God literally, tangibly, was the legal owner of the land. And an Israelite fully understood he did not have a fee simple ownership of the plot of land upon which he dwelled, he farmed, he ranched. And this foundational principle is explicitly embodied in the laws of Moses. And that is the reason that the laws of Moses had these complex and highly nuanced procedures about possessing and passing along and redeeming land. It was also one of the most important reasons for the existence of the office of the kinsman redeemer, and was perhaps his primary obligation to the family. That being the case, then what was Naomi's relationship with the property, the land, that's being discussed here? After all, see, this is the key to understanding both Naomi's predicament and her solution to the problem of land inheritance. First of all, now that we better understand the laws of land inheritance in Israel, we must see that Naomi was not in actual legal possession of that land. For one thing, if she was in legal possession, why was she and Ruth even in such poverty? For another, even if she wasn't physically able, or maybe didn't even have the skills to farm the land, she certainly could have leased out the field to another and obtained income, however meager. Second, if Naomi didn't control the land, who did? And when did someone else gain control of the land and under what circumstance? The truth is that only speculation is possible, because this issue is simply not directly addressed in the story. As Frederick Bush, the editor of the World Biblical Commentary on Ruth, says, and I paraphrase him, the author of this story and the people who read it in much earlier times had information and knowledge about the circumstances that was probably just common knowledge for them. And further, the circumstances themselves probably explained a very logical and usual course of action of that era that would have resulted from the peculiarities of this case. So this is muddled only to our Western Gentile minds, but not at all to the ancient Hebrews who lived near the time the book of Ruth was written. They understood what was going on. I mean, I couldn't agree more with Frederick Bush. We just don't often consciously realize it. But we take an enormous amount of things for granted in our daily conversations. And even from what we read in books and news articles that are written and read, if a contemporary story takes place in America and it speaks of a monetary transaction, for example, there's no need for the author to explain that the monetary denomination is the dollar, or what a dollar is, or that the dollar went off the gold standard many years ago, or that a dollar has a fluctuating and relative value to other currencies, and on and on and on. If the article is about American food, it's not necessary to explain what is defined as food and what is not. Beef or bread is food, worms and plankton are not. But in future times, the conditions will likely be radically different. And such precise definitions as what food is and what money is going to change. And a new normal will exist. And the one from 1,000 years earlier is going to be completely forgotten. Further, when a person in the year, let's say 3000, reads about all the things going on in the world in 2019, it'll be quite necessary for that person to research to understand just what the conditions were at this time, what certain words meant in the context of our day, because languages steadily evolve, and what the laws were, all of this and more, or they'll miss what's being communicated. We face that problem every time we open up the Bible. And nowhere is it better demonstrated than here in the 4th chapter of Ruth and the matter of the land transaction that is occurring in a biblical and Middle Eastern construct, not a modern Western setting. And since it can only be that Naomi did not possess the land, because by law she can't, and she had no right to hold it or dispose of it because she wasn't a legal heir, then one of two things was occurring at Bethlehem's gate. Either the land was in possession of some other unnamed person who had legally acquired it at some earlier point from Elimelech when he was alive, and thus the purpose of Boaz, or this anonymous senior Goel, was to redeem it back from that unnamed owner, or Naomi's arrival back at Bethlehem signaled that it was time that the land issue for Elimelech's family finally be decided by the clan's nearest of kin, the family's Goel, so that a clan member officially took control of the land as a matter of preemption. In other words, the first situation is one of getting the land returned to the family or the clan, redeeming it. The second situation is a matter of keeping the land from getting transferred out of the family or the clan by means of a near relative purchasing it, preempting the possibility of its sale outside of the clan. Which is it? Which one's going on here? Clearly, it does not seem credible that the land was just sitting there, unused, going fallow, for no other reason than by the strictest legal sense, because Elimelech and his sons had died and there was no legal heir to inherit, especially since Elimelech's surviving widow and daughter-in-law were obviously recognized by the entire community as being legitimate family members. Certainly, the entire basis of this story is lost if Naomi still had some control over the land, or more correctly, control of the use of it. For one thing, a person who has land has no right to glean in somebody else's field. So it can only be one thing, The land had been sold at some earlier point, and now it was necessary to try to get it back into the family and the clans by the legal means the laws of Moses provided, redeeming it. It could be that when Elimelech was leaving Judah for Moab, that's when he sold the land, or better, the use of the land, to someone outside of his family, maybe even outside of his clan. Because if a clan member had purchased it by rights, when Elimelech or his legal heir was available to reclaim it, it had to be returned to the original owner, according to the laws of Torah. In fact, this reality will play a critical role in what this unnamed senior Goel, sitting in opposition to Boaz, ultimately decides to do when he's presented with an opportunity to purchase this land. So it can only be that someone outside of Elimelech's clan had purchased this land, either upon Elimelech leaving for Moab, maybe while he was still living there. So if a member of another clan of Judah, that was his tribe, purchased it from Elimelech some years earlier, due to Elimelech maybe, and maybe Elimelech and his family being in monetary distress, and now Naomi's return from Moab triggers the issue that someone from Elimelech's clan has to redeem the land back to the original family and clan according to the laws of Moses. But also according to the laws of Moses, the current owner would be owed money by the man of Elimelech's clan who would sign up to be the Goel. The family redeemer would have to pay money for this land. I know this has your head spinning. But I want to remind you that to the people of Ruth's era, this was just common knowledge and expected procedure. So the situation is this. A member of another clan, likely another clan of the tribe of Judah, currently holds possession of Elimelech's land. Naomi has returned from Moab as a childless widow and now pushes the issue of how to get the land returned to the clan. And if at all possible, to her family, technically Elimelech's family. The importance of this issue is fully recognized by all the community of Bethlehem. And so is Naomi's plight as being a widow woman and having no right to redeem the land herself. That's the situation. Then this brings up a question. How's Ruth involved in all this? And the answer to that is in verse 5. When Boaz tells Mr. So-and-so that if he agrees to redeem Naomi's family land, he's also going to have to marry Ruth, Naomi's daughter-in-law. Why? The answer is at the end of that same verse. In order to raise up the name of the deceased, an heir for his property. The statement now raises two more issues. First of all, how does Ruth having a child solve the issue of land for Naomi? And second, by what law, Torah law, is there an obligation for Mr. So-and-so to have to marry Ruth if he agrees to buy the land? Again, most Christian scholars going back centuries have said that Boaz married Ruth due to obligations of levirate marriage, and that the kinsman redeemer had the legal duty to redeem the land, so that solved the land problem. And actually, neither of these assumptions is true according to the laws of Moses. So let's dissect this, see if we can come to some conclusions about it. First, as I said in an earlier lesson, levirate marriage plays no role whatsoever in this process. Levirate marriage applies to a very narrow situation. Only does it apply to the brother of a deceased man being legally obligated to marry his dead brother's widow. There is no extension of this to another family member to perform this duty that is contained within the laws of Moses. Further, while there is an obligation of the family redeemer to redeem the land and to keep it in the clan, there is no law of Torah that requires him to marry anybody, nor to father a child, to produce an heir for a deceased man. So neither situation applies, and we are left scratching our heads as to why all this drama is playing out at the city gates and why it's unfolding this way. In verse 6, the senior kinsman redeemer tells Boaz that while he'd be happy to buy the land to redeem it, he cannot also marry Ruth because, for some reason, it would put his own inheritance at risk. Why would marrying Ruth cause his personal inheritance to be put into jeopardy? I told you this was really complex. I'm going to tell you the answer to that momentarily, but first I want to explain something to you. What we are seeing from a much broader view is that there is no specific commandment of God that either Boaz or Mr. So-and-so would find themselves breaking if one or the other did not marry Ruth, give her an heir, and to a degree, even if they didn't redeem the land. The circumstances of this case just do not directly apply to the laws of levirate marriage or to land redemption. So what's the point of this entire exercise? One of the major things that all generations, I really want you to hear this, please. One of the major things that all generations of God's people, Israelite or Gentile believer, the thing that we can learn from the story of Ruth is how to carry out God's justice and mercy even when none of the 613 laws of Torah seem to directly apply. And how you manage to do that is by doing something that I have discussed with you on scores of occasions. We discern God's principles that are the foundation for all of his laws and commandments. God tells us that the basis for the Ten Commandments is to love your God with all your mind, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And that just as the Ten Commandments are built upon those two foundational God principles, so are all of his 613 laws built upon the Ten Commandments. So when we're at point A, and we have on our hands a matter that demands our attention and our action, it is in our court to see how we get to point B, which is the solution. And under many circumstances, we can simply point to one of the Ten Commandments or one of the 613 laws, and it'll give us the proper route to get from point A to point B. But under many more situations, the route's not obvious, or there just isn't a nonstop flight from A to B. Point A in the book of Ruth is that Naomi and Ruth are poverty-stricken widows. They have no children and have no hope. Co-located at point A is that the land that belonged to Naomi's deceased husband, Elimelech, is in the hands of somebody else outside of his clan. Point B, then, is to find a way to financially care for Naomi and Ruth along with a way to have the land redeemed and returned to the family. But how do we get there? The most important thing to take away from this is that as God's followers, it's our moral obligation to find a way. To find a way that is consistent with God's principles, even if it is not directly covered by one or another of his laws. And I contend this is a position that the Hebrews found themselves in regularly. And we as Christians find ourselves in just as regularly as well. Let's rotate now back to Mr. So-and-so, who decided that it would cause his own inheritance to be put into question if he married Ruth. So here's what happened. See, he was happy to redeem that land and add it to his family's wealth that would eventually be passed along to his own descendants. You see, since Elimelech had no heir, remember that's point A in the story, the family Goel who redeemed the land got to keep the land, at least theoretically, until the year of Jubilee. So Mr. So-and-so knew full well that Elimelech had no heir. So whatever money this senior Goel, Mr. So-and-so, paid to the mystery man who currently owned Elimelech's land, it would be well spent, because the senior Goel would now possess Elimelech's land for himself and for his posterity. He liked that part. This was great. He loved it. He was anxious. I mean, look at this. There wasn't much of a bargain. You want to do this? Oh, yeah, man. Oh, yeah. I'll redeem that land. But then Boaz throws him a curveball. He says, oh, and by the way, accepting the obligation as the family redeemer also meant, Mr. So-and-so, you got to marry Ruth. And so from Ruth would come an heir for her dead husband, Mahlon, son of Elimelech. And because there is now an heir, Mr. So-and-so would be obligated to give the land he just paid money for to Ruth's son. Well, you didn't want to do that. He'd be out the money, out the land. And this, of course, diminished his own wealth, here called an inheritance. Bottom line, the senior Goel would have to pay redemption money for land he'd soon have to give away to Ruth's son. And even though the land would remain within the clan, it wouldn't be his personal land, and so he would receive no direct benefit from it. And remember, this son by Ruth would not even be considered his own son. But rather, this son would be considered Mahlon's son. The senior Goel would wind up getting no personal benefit from paying money for land and for marrying Ruth, so he declined. And he deferred to Boaz, who had already said he'd be happy to do it all. From a legal standpoint, Elimelech's land was posthumously inherited by his son, Mahlon. And then by means of Mahlon's widow, Ruth, marrying a qualified family Goel, a proper heir would be created for Mahlon. So the land passed from Elimelech to his son Mahlon, from Mahlon to the firstborn to Ruth. That son's biological father would be the family redeemer. Biological father. So now the line was connected from point A to point B, even if it was not a very straight line. Yet as we see from the story, as complicated and head-hurting as it seems for us to be able to follow, this was all very well understood by the participants in Ruth's day. What we find out is that whoever agrees to be the Goel also has the duty to perform all the obligations incumbent upon a goel. He can't do some of them and refuse to do the others. We also find out that at some point before the era of Ruth, the same kind of issues of how to deal with childless widows were dealt with by Israel's leaders because there was a void in the law of Moses for many cases, just like the one we're dealing with here. So they created a tradition. They created a man-made rule that a childless widow who had no brother-in-law to marry her could marry any family member who agreed to be the family goel, the family kinsman redeemer. And this marriage could then produce the needed heir for the deceased husband. And even more, the widow Ruth now has a husband to care for her. And by custom, her mother-in-law, Naomi, would be lovingly cared for by Boaz and Ruth. The marriage of Ruth to Boaz solves all the problems that the story of Ruth presents. So, in our story, the senior goel cedes his rights of redemption to Boaz, and he hands his sandal, that smelly sandal, to Boaz as a symbolic gesture used in that era to seal a deal. The 10 attending elders attest to the arrangement, and at that moment, or more accurately, once he pays the money to this unknown possessor of the land of Elimelech is redeemed back into the clan. Further, Boaz agrees that the first son, just the first one, the first son born to he and Ruth will be in the name of Ruth's deceased husband, Mahlon. Let's be clear that the term name, Shem in Hebrew, does not mean name as in Bradford or Smith or Jones. It means attributes. It means characteristics. It means rights of inheritance. Then after the elders publicly notarize this agreement, they pronounce a prayer and a blessing over Boaz and Ruth, asking God that he would make them very fruitful in children and descendants like Leah and Rachel did for Jacob. See, it's an interesting choice of women's names to invoke, I think, because Rachel and Leah had something in common with Ruth. They were all Gentiles before their Hebrew husbands married them. It's hard to get away from the fact that Gentiles always played key roles in building up the nation of Israel and in their redemption. In fact, when even the name of Tamar is mentioned in here as the mother of Peretz, Judah being the father, she too was a Gentile woman. And Peretz is mentioned because he is an ancestor of Boaz. Well, the challenges of this final chapter, Ruth, I'm afraid don't end with the legal proceedings at the city gates of Bethlehem. Because in staccato fashion, we're told that Boaz and Ruth had the son that was needed to keep the line of Mahlon alive, and in doing so, kept the line of Elimelech, then, from coming to a dead end. The thing is that verse 14 plainly states that this son of Ruth is seen by the women of Beit Lechem as a redeemer for Naomi. This passage is another one that causes many Bible scholars to conclude that this is a corrupt text, because up to now Boaz had been the redeemer. So they say it's not Ruth's child, but Boaz that this ought to be referring to. Nonsense. In fact, this verse links perfectly with the equally perplexing verse 17 that says that it was these same women of Bethlehem who named Naomi's son. Did you get that? Not Ruth's son, but Naomi's son. Not only that, but nowhere else in the Bible do we find anyone but the mother or the father giving their child its name. Neighbors naming your child? That was unheard of. But you see, this is what's so fantastic about the book of Ruth. The whole community knew that in some strange way, this marriage between Ruth and Boaz and this resultant first son was far more significant than merely concerning the private family matter of restoring land to the Elimelech clan line. This matter was profound. It was far-reaching in ways they could sense, but they didn't know how. And of course, in retrospect, we know that this son went on to be the grandfather of the future King David. And from David's line came the even more future Redeemer of the entire world, Yeshua of Nazareth. I also want to point out an important grammatical technicality. When verse 14 says that the women said that Jehovah has provided Naomi with a redeemer, it is probably much more accurate to translate it that Naomi was provided with redemption. Because that Hebrew word that is usually translated as redeemer is not goel, which means kinsman redeemer, but ga'al. Goel is a noun. That, again, more or less means kinsman redeemer, a person. But ga'al is a verb. It means redeeming. In other words, the intent is not to indicate a person, but rather an action, a behavior. So the intent is not to name Ruth's first son as Naomi's kinsman redeemer, but just that that son provided her with redemption. Now, as a housekeeping matter, the reference to the first son of Ruth as being Naomi's son is just a common way of speaking on a number of levels from that era. First, the word for son in Hebrew is ben. And ben, in one of its many and varied uses, is grandson. And this is because of the extreme closeness of extended families in that day. And because the eldest male family member continued to carry family authority until death. But on another level, this grandson more or less legally replaced Naomi's deceased son, Mahlon. And on yet another level, since Naomi was the widow of the deceased Elimelech, by the legal fiction of designating this male child of Ruth as Naomi's son, it also made him Elimelech's son. So this established now the proper heir of Elimelech's line. Trust, I'm not speaking to you in allegory. I'm not convoluting the storyline to try to make it fit. Quite the contrary. I'm explaining to you the ancient Hebrew thought pattern and cultural norms that existed in that time. And why we need to take this story just as it is and not try to remake it to suit our doctrines and our Western cultural thinking. The name the women of Bethlehem gave the son, Ruth's son, was Oved, which means worshiper or the serving one. The book ends with Oved's descendants, but first of all, it traces his ancestors back to Peretz, son of Judah, by Tamar. Again, notice, it's so interesting. The messianic line begins with a Gentile woman, Tamar. Then it makes a significant turn with yet another Gentile woman, Ruth. Of course, both of these Gentile women were drawn into the community of the set-apart people, Israel, in one way or another. Obed is the father of Ishai, Jesse. Jesse is the father of David. So the validity of King David's line and right to the throne of Israel is established by means of the story of Ruth. And the expectation of a mysterious kinsman redeemer that would affect not just Elimelech's line, but the entire community is presented here. But let's not let one other connection zoom by us. The son of Ruth, the one who redeems, was born where? Bethlehem. And then perhaps 125 years later, that son's grandchild, King David, was born where? Bethlehem. And then 1,000 years after that, Yosef and Miriam, who live far to the north in Nazareth of the Galilee, found themselves in Bethlehem for a few days, and there in the same place that Obed and David were brought into this world, so was Yeshua the Messiah. This ends the story of Ruth.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.